Life is complex. Join us for the simple gifts of wisdom, love, and delight in the written word. The Everlasting Man by G.K. Chesterton. Part 2 on the Man Called Christ. Chapter 4, The Witness of the Heretics.
Part 4.
But there was something that did not end. There had arisen in that hour of history defiance above the democratic tumult of the councils of the church, Athanasius against the world. We may pause upon the point at issue, because it is relevant to the whole of this religious history, and the modern world seems to miss the whole point of it. We might put it this way. If there is one question which the enlightened and liberal have the habit of deriding and holding up as a dreadful example of barren dogma and senseless sectarian strife, it is this Athanasian question of the co-eternity of the divine Son. On the other hand, if there is one thing that the same liberals always offer us as a piece of pure and simple Christianity, untroubled by doctrinal disputes, it is the single sentence, God is love. Yet the two statements are almost identical. At least one is very nearly nonsense without the other. The barren dogma is the only logical way of stating the beautiful sentiment. For if there be a being without beginning, existing before all things, was he loving when there was nothing to be loved? If, through that unthinkable eternity, he is lonely, what is the meaning of saying he is love? The only justification of such a mystery is the mystical conception that in his own nature there was something analogous to self-expression, something of what begets and beholds what it has begotten. Without some such idea, it is really illogical to complicate the ultimate essence of deity with an idea like love. If the moderns really want a simple religion of love, they must look for it in the Athanasian Creed. The truth is that the trumpet of true Christianity, the challenge of the charities and simplicities of Bethlehem or Christmas Day, never rang out more arrestingly and unmistakably than in the defiance of Athanasius to the cold compromise of the Arians. It was emphatically he who really was fighting for a God of love against a God of colorless and remote cosmic control, the God of the Stoics and the Agnostics. It was emphatically he who was fighting for the Holy Child against the gray deity of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. He was fighting for that very balance of beautiful interdependence and intimacy in the very Trinity of the divine nature that draws our hearts to the Trinity of the Holy Family. His dogma, if the phrase be not misunderstood, turns even God into a holy family. That this purely Christian dogma actually, for a second time, rebelled against the empire, and actually, for a second time, refounded the church in spite of the empire, is itself a proof that there was something positive and personal working in the world, other than whatever official faith the empire chose to adopt. This power utterly destroyed the official faith that the empire did adopt. It went on its own way, as it is going on its own way still. There are any number of other examples in which is repeated precisely the same process we have reviewed in the case of the Manichaean and the Arian. A few centuries afterwards, for instance, the Church had to maintain the same Trinity, which is simply the logical side of love, against another appearance of the isolated and simplified deity in the religion of Islam. Yet there are some who cannot see what the Crusaders were fighting for, and some even who talk as if Christianity had never been anything but a form of what they call Hebraism, coming in with the decay of Hellenism. Those people must certainly be very much puzzled by the war between the Crescent and the Cross. If Christianity had never been anything but a simpler morality sweeping away polytheism, there is no reason why Christendom should not have been swept into Islam. The truth is that Islam itself was a barbaric reaction against that very humane complexity that is really a Christian character. That idea of balance in the deity, as of balance in the family, that makes that creed a sort of sanity, and that sanity the soul of civilization. And that is why the Church is from the first a thing holding its own position and point of view, quite apart from the accidents and anarchies of its age. That is why it deals blows impartially right and left at the pessimism of the Manichaean or the optimism of the Pelagian. It was not a Manichaean movement because it was not a movement at all. It was not an official fashion because it was not a fashion at all. It was something that could coincide with movements and fashions, could control them, and could survive them. So might rise from their graves the great heresiarchs to confound their comrades of today. There is nothing that the critics now affirm that we cannot call on these great witnesses to deny. The modern critic will say, lightly enough, that Christianity was but a reaction into asceticism and anti-natural spirituality, a dance of fakirs, furious against life and love. But Manes, the great mystic, will answer them from his secret throne and cry, "These Christians have no right to be called spiritual. These Christians have no title to be called ascetics. They who compromised with the curse of life and all the filth of the family. Through them the earth is still foul with fruit and harvest and polluted with population. Theirs was no movement against nature, or my children would have carried it to triumph. But these fools renewed the world when I would have ended it with a gesture." And another critic will write that the Church was but the shadow of the empire, the fad of a chance emperor, and that it remains in Europe only as the ghost of the power of Rome. And Arius the deacon will answer out of the darkness of oblivion, "No, indeed, or the world would have followed my more reasonable religion, for mine went down before demagogues and men defying Caesar, and around my champion was the purple cloak, and mine was the glory of the eagles. It was not for lack of these things that I failed." And yet a third modern will maintain that the creed spread only as a sort of panic of hellfire, men everywhere attempting impossible things in fleeing from incredible vengeance, a nightmare of imaginary remorse. And such an explanation will satisfy many who see something dreadful in the doctrine of orthodoxy. And then there will go up against it the terrible voice of Tertullian, saying, "And why then was I cast out? And why did soft hearts and heads decide against me when I proclaimed the perdition of all sinners? And what was this power that thwarted me when I threatened all backsliders with hell? For none ever went up that hard road so far as I, and mine was the credo quia impossibile." Then there is the fourth suggestion, that there was something of the Semitic secret society in the whole matter, that it was a new invasion of the nomad spirit shaking a kindlier and more comfortable paganism, its cities and its household gods, whereby the jealous monotheistic races could after all establish their jealous god. And Muhammad shall answer out of the whirlwind, the red whirlwind of the desert. Who ever served the jealousy of God as I did, or left him more lonely in the sky? Who ever paid more honor to Moses and Abraham, or won more victories over idols and the images of paganism? And what was this thing that thrust me back with the energy of a thing alive, whose fanaticism could drive me from Sicily and tear up my deep roots out of the rock of Spain? What faith was theirs who thronged in thousands of every class and country, crying out that my ruin was the will of God? And what hurled Godfrey as from a catapult over the wall of Jerusalem? And what brought great Sobieski like a thunderbolt to the gates of Vienna? I think there was more than you fancy in the religion that has so matched itself with mine. Those who would suggest that the faith was a fanaticism are doomed to an eternal perplexity. In their account, it is bound to appear as fanatical for nothing, and fanatical against everything. It is ascetical and at war with ascetics, Roman and in revolt against Rome, monotheistic and fighting furiously against monotheism, harsh in its condemnation of harshness, a riddle not to be explained even as unreason. And what sort of unreason is it that seems reasonable to millions of educated Europeans through all the revolutions of some 1600 years? People are not amused with a puzzle or a paradox or a mere muddle in the mind for all that time. I know of no explanation except that such a thing is not unreason, but reason. That if it is fanatical, it is fanatical for reason, and fanatical against all the unreasonable things. That is the only explanation I can find of a thing from the first so detached and so confident, condemning things that looked so like itself, refusing help from powers that seemed so essential to its existence, sharing on its human side all the passions of the age, yet always at the supreme moment, suddenly rising superior to them. Never saying exactly what it was expected to say, and never needing to unsay what it had said. I can find no explanation except that, like Pallas from the brain of Jove, it had indeed come forth out of the mind of God, mature and mighty and armed for judgment and for war.
'Tis the gift to be simple. 'Tis the gift to be free. 'Tis the gift to come down where we ought to be. And when we find ourselves in the place just right, 'twill be in the valley of love and delight. When true simplicity is gained, to bow and to bend, we will not be ashamed. To turn, turn, will be our delight, till by turning, turning, we come round right.